Exception number 8941, rule number 13.
Manager Jefferson, rule 13.
We were, you asked about who was supporting whom. The 11th Field was supporting the 5th Indian Infantry Brigade. I was FOO with the 1st 4th Essex Battalion. 83-85 actually went into snap action because we got into trouble going into the mountains.
The
yeah, well, because they got into trouble. And I'm pretty certain that they called for help. You're trying to ask me who helped whom and when. And we did a snap action. We did a bit of a shoot. In fact, going through the whole of this gorge leading up to this position at the end, I think the position was called Cairo, if I remember right. No, that may be another one. We did a leapfrogging action, and indeed I now remember the report from the gun position that in one place I'd called for fire where they could only get in 3 guns on one side of the road and had to find a home somewhere else for the 4th gun. And then the infantry were in front of me as we approached this enormous depression, and I was in fact in my armoured car on a sort of smooth moorland behind them on my own, but giving them moral support, and they could always send a runner back to me as I kept up with them. And it was from there that I did this terrible bad shooting with smoke to try and find out where the hell we were, because I didn't even know where the guns were, and I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what the wadi was in front, so I wasted, I say, a lot of smoke shell and didn't see a sign of it. But eventually the next picture I have of myself is on their left, and the infantry are now held up on a reverse slope with Joe Young, I can see with his little group round him, his signaller, and I'm doing my clinometer laying close shoot on the left hand side of the road, where there's this chap, he was a sniper when I come to think about it. I don't know if I used the word sniper in connection with him earlier, but he was a sniper. But behind him, of course, there was a wadi full of people, and I got the shells to go over the top of the thing and almost knock his hat off and burst in the wadi behind him. And while just after that, I remember I talked to you about my flapping raincoat lining like a teddy bear. I remember flopping across the reverse slope to Joe Young and asking him if he needed any particular help. I don't think he particularly wanted any particular help. I went to call him. He was held up at the time. But I guess we carried on firing. Whether it was to please him or to please me, I don't know.
There must have been considerable difficulties with dead ground in those mountains.
Enormous. I lost, I think, well over 30 shells. Smoke shells, airbursts, and I couldn't even see a sign that they'd been there.
And then you were just trying to...
I was using them to...
Mark your own position and mark the battery.
If you're on reasonable ground, you put out one airburst, or perhaps two airbursts, and you can get a line of sight on it. But I couldn't get anything to visible at all, because it was going into this very deep wadi.
Did you see any Italian guns in action in that advance through those hills?
Well, yes, because underneath the crest, and I think it was called Cairo, though Cairo may have been another battle. Yes, it was called Cairo. Underneath that crest, there were these Italian guns dug in, and you could clearly see their flashes from certain parts of the field. And as I say, I actually went over the gun positions and advanced beyond them later in the day.
What sort of guns did they have?
If they weren't like something like an American, a French or American 75, I'd be very surprised. That was the type of gun I have in memory, but I wasn't looking at them from that point of view.
Did you try and bring any fire down on them?
Yes. Oh, yes. We shot them up, and I think probably that was helpful. But by the time we got there, the gunners had gone.
They'd just cleared off, had they, leaving their guns behind them.
Yeah.
Was it particularly difficult to actually put shells in onto a dug-in gun position like that?
Well, they weren't. They were semi-dug-in. They were.
They're on a terrace, weren't they?
Yes,
below the crest.
A terrace is a very good way of describing it. They were almost like plant pots, large plant pots, large shallow plant pots on a terrace. I don't remember that day doing any shoot that would justify the description you've just given it. It isn't difficult. I could do it today, even. In my dotage, do a fine shoot and knock out a gun position, provided I was given enough time and shells and visibility. And certainly it would have been possible to have done it there, but I don't think our battle lasted that long that I actually knocked out gun by gun. I just put down gunfire on their gun position.
And then their gunners ran for it, and their infantry decided the game was up.
That I don't know. The infantry gave themselves up when I got near them, and by the time I got to the gun position, the gunners weren't there. So,
did you see where their own shells falling, the Italian shells? Did you see where their fall of shot went?
Well, some of it went fairly close to us. I mean, the Italian gunners were.
It was accurate.
Yes. That particular day, I think it was more machine gun fire that and sniper fire and mines, but the gun they were firing, and they were firing at us, and some of their fire was not ineffective, but I don't think it was very heavy. Perhaps they hadn't got all that much ammunition. I don't remember that.
What sort of formation did the Essex use to advance over this mountain terrain? Did you notice?
Well, there was a forward company and I was with it, and what was happening behind me I don't know, but there must have been other companies. I think probably a diamond would be quite a normal because it was a fairly narrow defile. I've no doubt that I can find reference if you were interested in that fact. But in fact, I'm sure I can, because I've got a history of the Essex Regiment there. But a diamond would be a very normal way for them to do it.
And what about that point company that was leading the way? How were they actually laid out on the ground and organised?
Flat when I came to them. I don't know. The company commander was fairly well forward, but he certainly wasn't the leading man.
Do you know if they had a regular practice of having one platoon up and two back, or two up and one
switch
back
off for
going
a minute,
through
I'll
mountains?
Try and answer. You were asking about the order of battle, the way we approached the attack in the hills, and from the Essex Regiment's own history, it's very clear that 5th Indian Brigade was on the inside of the Weald Division, and by the morning of the 25th of March had secured the Halluf Pass into the hills. The enemy behind Medellin had relied on mines and demolitions to hold us up, but these had been cleared within 24 hours, and we passed through with the 1st 4th Essex as leading battalion. On the 26th of March, D Company led the advance, followed by the commanding officer with battalion headquarters. Progress was slow owing to the uneven road and the mines that were still being lifted by the sappers and miners. But at 10:40 a.m., first contact was made with the enemy, a party in a defensive position at a crossroad. I call that Cairo, I think it's called Hardy in a minute. D Company deployed, sending two platoons to the right. and the carriers under company command to the left, otherwise along the road. They were, in fact, I think, behind. I know they may be the chaps who pulled the mines away. At the same time, machine gun fire was brought to bear on the enemy forward positions. This first engagement was short, and 12 prisoners had been taken by 11 a.m. The artillery then opened fire, while D Company continued to advance round the features occupied by the enemy, and by 11:30 a.m. the company had reported a further 15 prisoners. I think those were the ones that I took, but I'm not 100% certain of that. Shortly after this, enemy resistance was overcome, and the number of prisoners was raised to 80. At 1 p.m. the column was able to continue its advance, but the advance was still slow owing to the number of mines that had to be lifted. Prisoners taken proved to be from the Italian Pistoia division. By 4 p.m. the column had reached a point known as Hardy, on the crest of the Martyr Hills, where it came under heavy artillery fire. Lieutenant Colonel Noble then went forward to reconnoitre the situation. It was clear that the main position of the enemy rearguard had now been encountered. While patrols and engineer patrols went forward to find the enemy position and any possible demolitions, the battalion deployed and took up defensive positions. The patrols returned early on the morning of the 27th of March without having contacted the enemy or finding any further demolition for approximately 4,000 yards ahead. Lieutenant Colonel Noble then ordered A Company, Hugh Gregory, to secure Hardy, with C Company holding a firm base in the rear. B and D Companies were to follow in column and be prepared to pass through once Hardy had been captured, and to make for two further objectives, Swan and Edgar. There was the diamond formation I suggested is the one. The battalion advanced at 8 a.m. and forward companies soon came under heavy shell fire, as did the road up which the column was advancing. A Company's 1,500-weight truck and 3-tonner loaded with company stores, etc., were both hit. But by 3 p.m. Hardy had been reached and a further 80 prisoners taken. The day's total was to exceed 200 at a cost of 9 Essex casualties.
What were these hills actually like? Were they steep or fairly easy going on the slopes?
They were mountain climbing. I mean, I was in my truck all the day, except that I parked at the very end where I told you I was off to the right. I parked it and climbed an escarp. Well, 100 foot easy climbing. I mean, scrambling. But scrambling to look over to the next, to where I could see the road beneath me.
What about the ground? Was it bare rock or was there vegetation?
My memory is bare rock there, though there always is a bit of vegetation that you don't even notice, but it was pretty bare rock. It was pretty sand-burnt rock, typical of that part of the world.
I'd also like to ask you a bit about the Essex, because you'd presumably been with them for considerable length of time, so you must have got to know them fairly well. What sort of men were there in that regiment?
Well, I just reread. I went to an Essex all ranks reunion about in 1968, or I think it would be. I guess on the 20, just after the 25th anniversary. Remembering my TA days in the Manchester Artillery, where to go into the sergeant's mess was to risk a very severe headache next morning, and to hear a large number of extremely ribald songs, and to be expected to a clap, appalling singing, which I first thought it was they were being funny, and they were being serious.
It's a matter of courtesy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, wait a minute. Anyway, that is my memory of my TA camps. And when I went to the Essex Regiment reunion dinner, it was an extremely orderly and pleasant and ordered, but animated event. Their colonel, Arthur Noble, of course, was a great, great man. He's one of the chaps who saved something of the Territorial Army when it was about to be wiped out. He, I think he got a knighthood for it, for that very thing. Their second in command was also a splendid fellow. He commanded one of the companies on in July. Their carrier platoon officer I've seen from time to time, and he visited this house only a couple of months ago. He was he's vice chairman of a gas company. Their anti-tank platoon on that date eventually became Director General of Army Education, a chap called Beckett. And their other ranks were very from the splendid NCOs that one finds in almost any regiment, except that they spoke with an Essex accent. And the others that I met, I said, in later years, I knew to be quite sober citizens. Although I knew them well, I knew individuals. You asked me, for instance, to identify the shape of Hugh Gregory's or Joe Young's company on the ground. I wasn't looking for them, I was looking for him. Yeah. As in business one does, it's the people you know. And obviously if you're looking for a company, you're looking for the company commander. And if he's a chap you know, well, if you're looking for a chap with a white hair and a white moustache, that's what you see.
Did you know there at the time where what sort of chaps they were, whether they were regular or conscript or TA, whether they were from the rural part of Essex or basically from the fringes of London? Did that become apparent to you?
No. I think I knew they were TA because I was a terrier myself, so to that extent, well, if not TA, yeomanry. And you've only just reminded me, of course, that Essex includes the middle London. I always think of it as being rural anyway. And it was Ilford that I went to this dinner. Whether that's rural, I just think that's fairly rural. But I suppose, in fact, some of them came from Dagenham, when I come to think about it. But I've always thought of Essex as being, and particularly because they were either yeomanry or TA types, I always thought of them as being a bit agricultural.
It's conceivable, of course, the officers were rural and that the men were from places like Romford.
I went to Arthur Noble's, some of them certainly came from Romford, but I went to Arthur Noble's funeral and he came from Chigwell. At least that's where he was buried.
Was there any social mixing between the men from your regiment and the 1st 4th Essex?
There was very little social mixing of any sort between anyone because there was no social life. If even within bomb troop, number one and number four gun were a few hundred yards apart. And we had very little opportunity for social life of any sort. We lived in the desert. Without women, one made a life in one's troop, one made a life in one's battery. Even within a regiment, there was quite a distinction between 78, 84 and 83, 85. And I could take you through our day of 2nd of July, hour by hour, minute by minute. But I have very little knowledge of what went on in the 8th and 4th on the 3rd of July. They had a pretty good day then. I got on very friendly terms with a lot of the chaps from the 1st, 4th Essex. Later on in the war, in Italy, of course, there was a bit more social life because there were towns and buildings and people. And there I got on pretty friendly terms with the officers of all nations of the 3rd Trail Fendia Force. But there one had much more chance to meet than in the desert. In Greece, of course, we had to put on shows and went and ate meals in restaurants, that sort of thing. In the whole of my time in the desert, I didn't see any form of social life until you overheard part of that thing about when we eventually found a farm just outside Tunis, and everyone had a glass of wine and fell down and in high inebriation. We had been like Bedouins, except the Bedouins take their tents and their women with them. We were like monastic Bedouins.
You were saying much earlier on about how in the regiment there was such a spirit of instinctive cohesion and mutual understanding between all subunits and individuals that an order could be given really in a sort of casual verbal shorthand and everyone would know what it meant and would automatically do the right thing. Now,
it would automatically do what they thought was the right thing.
Right thing,
quite
yes.
Often was the right thing, not always.
But anyway, there was a rapport, a fairly broad rapport. Did this rapport cross the boundary so that the Essex and your battery or regiment were able to act upon the same sort of basis? In other words, did you become so familiar with each other's habits as units that when the Essex did something, they didn't have to explain because you'd automatically understand what they were doing, and the same was true if you did something without prior warning to them?
I wouldn't like to express it quite as in such definite terms as you have done, and yet at the same time there is a certain grain of truth in what you just said. From the time we all put up the shite wall, there was an enormous camaraderie in the 4th Indian Division.
A divisional
and
feeling.
When I was supporting Indian troops, I was there to have Karnawala. You know? And that's one of the reasons I wore my 4.5 hats, I've said. And they would always be happy to pull out a jar of chaff or their Tope Karnawala. It was, of course, easier with the 1st, 4th, Essex, in that we all spoke the same language. It was perhaps even more necessary with the 3rd, 12th, 24th, because I didn't speak much Hindustani. The answer to your question is yes, to a degree, but not in such definite terms as you put the question.
One would presume that it would be a lesser degree than within the regiment, because there'd have been...
Not necessarily. I think I was probably closer to the 1st, 4th, Essex and the 3rd, 12th, Frontier Force than I ever was to the 78-84, because I never did any service in 78-84. Just as after many years I've just remade contact with my old Manchester Artillery mates, and I had lunch the other day with 19, of whom 2 joined on the same day that I did. But they joined 205 Battery and I got to 206 Battery. And their war was totally different to mine, even though I subsequently found that we were within yards of one another for quite large parts of it. So I think the relationship between a battery and its infantry is closer than between two batteries in the type of conditions we were talking about. Now, in cantonment, obviously, the regiment and the colonel... and the RSM are there, and the regimental flag. But when you're out in the middle of a desert, you're with your own little group of infantry, and your other battery may be hundreds of miles away. I mean, we received a gun and reinforcement from 32nd Field. Now, in fact, 9 guns of 32nd Field were way down in the south by Himaimat on the 2nd of July. Out of water, lost, out of petrol, but one chap had been on the main road and he joined us. certainly my battery and 1st, 4th Essex and 3rd, 12th, 24th are always very close. And I have a great feeling for Gurks because I like Gurks. And early before last Alamein, I had a very good rapport with the 416 Frontier Force. 416th Punjabis, I beg your pardon. Because I went out on patrol with a couple of their chaps. I see one at our reunion at the end of October, and if only he had a pair of desert boots, bottle creepers on, I'd go out with it. Within patrol tonight, because he looked just the same, you know.
So this close relationship was built on mutual dependence then and joint operations.
I think that all close relationships are built on shared experience, and you share experience with people that either have very similar interest to you or very similar requirements, or you're facing the same problems or the same opportunities.
But you don't need a similar sort of background.
Indeed. One of my late best friends, I think I've already told you, is Bhuta Singh Bhagwan, who was a Sikh. And Sikhs are quarrelsome people by nature. But Boots was one of my great best friends, and I'd fallen his neck if I saw him tomorrow. And equally, I've had very good friends who are Muslims. Having the same background can be very helpful, but it can also, of course, be a bar. Because if you don't have a similar background, you're not in competition with each other.
And if there's a problem to be solved, you can look at it from
two different
an objective.
Two different views, but with the same objective. If you come from the same background, you probably have one view and one objective, and maybe it's not as good as the two always. But there are exceptions to all these statements I've just made, and I don't like making statements that read out of context would mean something that I didn't mean. Are we going to finish this today?